Diane Sands interviewing Robert Holderman.
Raymond Holderman.
Raymond Holderman, excuse me, for the oral history of Fort Peck Dam. Why don't you start by just telling me something about your family background and what they were doing before you got involved in the dam.
All right. We came from Wolf Point in 1926 when the railroad terminal moved. It brought about 40 families into Glasgow. And so then I was in the school system there till I got out of school. And in the summer of 37, I got out as a table waiter at Edison Miller for 3 months. And of course, it was a magnificent sum to me. I had to live in the barracks, and it was about $88 a month that you got paid, and your board and room was about $30. And it was a little difficult for me because I had really never lived amongst a bunch of men before, and they were pretty rough characters. And at times, I get a little homesick. They used to play a lot of tricks on me because, for one thing, being the kid of the outfit, they always looked out for me, but they'd all go out in 2 taxicabs and hit these joints around, and Thursday was their payday night, and they'd stay out and come trickling in. I'd be sleeping. So they liked to have me there because that way nobody would bother their barracks. Anyway, they'd sneak in there, and our beds were just like the old Army hospital beds. And I never knew how many of them picked the bed up, but they would take that bed and they'd flip it up and lay me down, and the mattress was just about level height with the top of the bed, so it didn't hurt me, but I just stuck to it from the gravity. When I'd wake up, I'd be pinned under the bed, and they'd all be undressed and ready for bed, and when I'd get out from under there and turn on the light, everybody's in bed. So this went on for a while, and I decided I had to put a stop to that, so I went to the cook one night after they'd all left. They had a night cook that got ready for the next day, and I got a bunch of hard half split peas and some salt. And I short sheeted a bunch of them and salted them, and I put peas in the other one. And that night, they flipped me over when they come in, and they all ran and jumped in bed. And I crawled out from under it, and they're all there. It was hot. It's 100 degrees out there. Laying there in that salt and all those perches, nobody moved. They wouldn't say a thing. They never said anything to me, but they never turned me over anymore. anyway, then I went back to school and finished school over there. But I would like to move away from myself for a minute and talk about my father. He was a railroad man and a businessman in Glasgow and had homesteaded in Wolf Point. But at any rate, politics were his hobby, and although he only had a fifth grade education, I felt that he had at least a college degree in political science he read constantly. He could name every senator in the United States, you know, and he could name your complete government, your cabinet, the congressman, every local level. That was his hobby. And we got the congressional record, and we were forced to read that. So I got off into the Democratic end of politics very early, and I enjoyed it, too. But at any rate, when crash came, he lost an eye by going to work in a coal mine because 25 years' rights wouldn't let him out on the railroad enough to make a living for his family, and there was no such thing as unemployment or any way you could get any help. When he lost that eye, that's when he had to sell out the property that we had on Front Street, where he had a block of property with a bulk oil station and a service station. But over the years, that politics helped him a lot. For a while, when the dam first started, he came out first in a brush gang clearing brush in 1932, and he rode on a flatbed truck out here in winter weather, and they work out there with Pulaskis and Hooks and whatnot. And he had a steam boiler license, so as soon as they came to where they were using that, he was working for a Massman Construction Company on the original trestle that they made where they were going to dump the rock and gravel out. And then probably run it out if it's short.
Nope, it's fine. Go right ahead.
All right. At any rate, he had done lots of campaigning for Governor Cooney, and when Governor Cooney was elected governor, he didn't live but a week, but he made 2 appointments, and one of them was my father to the state liquor store, which was a godsend to us because he was having a pretty rough time. He had cancer by then, and he had been to the doctors with it, but it was one of those deals. It was too late. He lived for 7 years without, but he ran that state liquor store and enjoyed himself very much because he liked people and he liked to talk to people, and he continued to talk to people and be active in promoting the Democrats at all levels. And
what was the politics of getting the dam set up?
Well, originally, the Army engineers were trying to work to the Tennessee Valley Authority to control the Missouri floods. And this is what it was all about. And up here, big squabble was each state was trying to get the money for their own state. And the Senator Wheeler was the head man in the Senate. He was able to with the help of the Army engineers and a few of his cohorts in the Senate, finally managed to push this through. But he was working on this, probably as early as 1926. And I think that they first started pushing it through in 1928, and 1932 was the first main cruise, but I couldn't tell you for certain when the survey crews went out. They went out ahead of that. But at any rate, my brother also worked out here at one time, and our family, as many people who were desperately poor in the area, because the grasshoppers had got the crops twice and the drought had got them five times. My father leased land and put crops in on three farms up towards the Old Pine area, and that's what happened to him. The drought got him five times. So it was very tough for everybody around here. And I can remember when the North Country farmers came to our house when they were hiring one time, and they didn't have any place to stay, and they were, Dad knew all these people from threshing from the North Country. He used to do about a 10-mile strip, and he had three steam engines and threshing rigs and bundle teams. The farmers themselves would put their own bundles up and work along the line as they went, from over above the Lester Bible community to over by Avondale. But anyway, he knew all these people, and they wanted to get a job on the dam, and they had no place to stay, and they're in town. We had a house that was about 24 feet by 50 feet, and in our unfinished upstairs, which was floored, this is in the wintertime, we had 75 of those farmers up there sleeping side by side on their bedrolls, and in the morning, as they went, got ready to get on the employment office, my mother fed them all and sent them on their way. And you didn't insult anybody in those days by trying to leave any money or say anything. All you said was thank you. But at any rate, that's a different kind of time, and people had to stay together. But as time rolled along, anyway, I was able to work into Fort Peck Dam in 1937, and I come out as a labor in a construction gang. And I worked the night that they shut the dam off. We had about 20 men in each crew, and these trains that were hauling gravel, and some had some bigger rock, but mostly at first it was gravel, and then we went to field boulders. We shut it off with gravel. I can't remember the exact time of night, but I was in the crew. The train never stopped. It might be 60 trainloads, carloads of gravel, and it moved at about a walk, about a fast walk, and you had men running along there on each side, opening up that thing and dumping it. And when that train was done, the next one is right on the tailgate of the caboose and moving right out. That's the way it went. You were at a trot all night long. And so at any rate, I was there at that point, and then I got a job as a sub-foreman because it was a dangerous job and all the smarter older men didn't want the job, and I took a job signaling and placing the quarry stone on the face side of the dam. And that was a good break for me because once you learn to do this job, they kept you, and I was only 17 when I started, and so I stayed when lots of older, stronger, smarter men were on a different job and were laid off. I was down to where there was only 50 men who were not permanent civil service that were still on the dam in 1941 when I was laid off. So I was very proud and happy to be able to make it that long.
How old were you when you got your first job on the dam?
And 16. And I told my mother I didn't want to go back to school because I didn't have any decent clothes, and I had to have an affidavit saying I was 18, and she was reluctant to sign it, very religious. But finally I told her, threatened her with quitting school, which I would have, and she signed this thing, and the man in the employment office knew better in Glasgow, but that's all he had to have, and he just smiled and sent me out. And I held that job when a lot of older guys got bounced and didn't make it. But
you said your mother was very religious. What were her objections to your going to work?
Well, the big objection was she didn't want to sign a lie on the affidavit. But at any rate, I was proud to be able to bring most of it home and give to her because all I wanted was enough to buy clothes for school. Mm-hmm. And at that time, I don't think any of the children or the people here thought about that there was anything wrong with helping the family every way you could. Just that, mm-hmm. Whereas now, as my own children, for instance, it was always the other way. You know, I put three sons through college, and you think about when you were a youngster, and then when your own children are youngsters, and it's a whole different ball game, a different world of people. I liked the people better when I was young.
Mm-hmm. So, what was the process of getting hired?
Well, you went out of the Glasgow Employment Office, and the second time, I don't remember too much about the first time when I went to work for Addison Miller. I think I reported to their hiring office. I had to live in the barracks at that time. If you were single, you must live in the barracks. But the next time I hired out in 1937, they were so crowded in all the barracks, and they were at a peak of about 10,000 men. And if you had a place to go other than the barracks, you didn't have to live here, so I lived at home. But I went to the personnel office in the administration building, down at the foot of the hill here in town. And you had to sign through and give your history of what you'd done and what you thought you could do and be fingerprinted. By then they were fingerprinting. And I guess I mentioned to you about being fingerprinted on the left hand twice, since I was so tired I never told them, because I wanted to get out of there and go home. So I had two left hands on that job anyway. At the gentleman that fingerprinted me was Harry Rybuck, and I remember he was out of Glasgow High School, and he was a typist and done this work, and he had worn his fingerprints off of his hands, and when they started fingerprinting, he said, "Ray, I still haven't got mine. They can't catch me when I've got anything on the end to fingerprint." And the man who became the head of the administration building was Lloyd Fierstead, who was my freshman algebra teacher. Not particularly popular, but probably the best teacher I ever had. I wasn't doing well in math, and when he got a hold of me, boy, he really put me back up on top. So there are a lot of people who came out here also and went into the school system out here. But originally, when they were hauling on the bus, I don't know if the school system part would pay any interest or not, but we had about, when the Fort Peck children were all being hauled and all of the towns surrounding here, the boom towns, into Glasgow to go to high school, we would have about 60 children in a class, and the seats were so tight in there you could just get in between them. I never heard any teacher complain about how many children they had to teach at a time. They were happy to have a job. A teacher got 125 and a coach got 135. Mind you, $10 extra for teaching and coaching. He had to do it because he loved it. But at any rate, we turned out some exceptional people, especially the class that followed me in 1938. Terence Kirkland, who invented the solar system and the lights of all our satellite systems. Bill Reed, who was a nuclear scientist. And Cecil Toff was a corporate lawyer in the Los Angeles area. They had a great many sharp people out of that particular group.
When you were already in Glasgow and all of these damn people came in, were they looked at differently than townspeople?
Oh, I really don't think so, except that you had not enough ladies to go around, and people like me that were still in high school, and you had young people out here that were well off as far as the payroll went. It was mighty hard for a guy who didn't have a car or any nice clothes to get a date with a girl in there that was old enough to go anyplace, because there was 10 men smiling at her. So it was that was the only thing. No, I don't think that they didn't come to Glasgow all the time, because all of them didn't have transportation. The boom towns were something else to see. Did you want me to tell about that business of the Butte miners?
Yes.
Well, there was a nightclub on the road in Wheeler. Wheeler Street was very, very wide. It must have been 50 yards across at least. And one side of it was pretty much beer joints and restaurants and the post office. That was about the size of it. But this particular place, there had been a dispute, a fist fight between half a dozen miners and engineers, so they agreed they were going to meet the next weekend and choose up sides and fight. So the miners and the engineers came, and there was 50 or 60 people on each side, I can't remember exactly, but the Butte miners had more people by about six, and they stalled around for a while on that. They were lined up right dead center across the middle of the dance floor, and all the chairs and the tables were pulled back. This was acceptable as long as they weren't going to break anything. But inasmuch as the Butte miners had six more men, they gave three men to the engineers, and they squared off and fist fought until they'd had enough. And then they all went over to the bar and shook hands and had a drink, and it was a different world. It was like the Old West without guns. My father ran the state liquor store, and I can't think who he appointed all the postmasters in this area, Van Eschen at Fort Peck, Sternhagen in Glasgow. I can't remember the minor ones around here. But at any rate, when he would bring his money out of the post office, because every other place in town was robbed by a Mutt and Jeff robber combination, except the post office, which was federal, and the liquor store, which was state. But my father had a full automatic weapon. He just hung on to the trigger and it spit seven shots. And he would come out with his money for the day's receipts, and inasmuch as he had appointed the postmaster, he told him, "Come anytime you're ready, Abe," and he'd knock on the door where the postmaster lived in the post office, and when he heard his dad's voice, he would recognize it, and then he would take his money. But they were the only two that weren't robbed. I thought that was quite a thing in those times. They only had the one deputy sheriff, whose station was right in the middle of the road. They had a bus depot and a sheriff's. Yeah, and of course he could not be everywhere, nor did they try to control it very much. You had open gambling, and Bert's Wheeler's night spot that was just on the corner as you come out of the Federal Reserve where the fence is, he had 120 taxi dancers there at one time. Some were very nice girls and some were not. But at any rate, he had three shifts in the band of 6 hours each, and you only had one period in the 24 hours of 6 hours where you didn't have a dance band going. And the bar ran the long way. It was about as long as this room, probably 150, 200 feet. And they had blackjack tables in there. I was only 16 at the time. I was going over to watch those people, so I used to stand against the wall. I couldn't buy a drink, of course. And they left me alone as long as I minded my business. Very interesting. Every time a dance would end, somebody would have been bumping somebody else, and outside would go men. About six exits on each side. You couldn't watch all the fights, but I was scooted out to watch a fight. Because these are big, strong construction stiffs, and the only ones that were going out to fight were usually half drunk. Most of the time it was one punch or two, big haymaker, and they'd shake hands and go back in and dance again. I never seen anybody go on with it, go on and on with it. So I thought it was kind of a strange thing, but I got a big kick out of watching them.
Why people get into fights?
Just over bumping each other, or little discussions of any kind. Mostly bumping each other on the dance floor. But when I was 1936, when I was here, I fought on a card at the Fort Pick Recreation Hall. I was working as a table waiter, and there were two fighters, one by the name of Mickey Connolly, rated six in the world in Ring magazine, who had just fought for the world title and didn't win it. He drew. You got to win to get it. And the other was Chuck Haynes, 145 pounds, was rated 10th. And they needed sparring partners. And they saw me working over there, and they asked me, could I fight? Well, I'd done a lot of street fighting, believe me. Because being little, I got knocked around a bit. So I figured, boy, here's my chance to learn something about boxing. So I worked out with those guys for 6 weeks. We used to do our road work in the morning before we went to work. And we worked a split shift, which was 6 to 6, because you only worked certain hours to feed the people. But anyway, I did learn quite a bit from those guys, especially Connolly, who was 128 pounds and I was 130. He was a beautiful boxer, and he didn't ever try to hurt me. But the other guy, Chuck Haynes, was a bit of an egomaniac, and there'd be 300 or 400 people there and a lot of good-looking girls in the crowd. And the guy I was to fight was a breed Indian by the name of Fred Short. He had blackened his eye. So I was supposed to jab at my left low, and he'd come over the top and knock me down. And finally, I hit him in that black eye because I got tired of being knocked down, and then he stopped doing that. But at any rate, it was a big thing for me because I did learn how to fight. And when I went back over to high school in Glasgow, well, then, man, I didn't have to back up from anybody then.
I bet. Was that fight held here?
That fight was held here, and that Indian TKO'd me, and at the end of the second round, they stopped the fight. I was never off my feet. But what happened was he had 200 fights in the CCs, and he was a Western Divisional Champion. I never knew about that. And it was a mismatch. He was 25 years old and 135 pounds. I was 16 years old and just starting to develop at 130, but they couldn't get anybody else to go against him, so they put me in there. In the first round, I was doing fine, and I'm dancing around there and teaching him a good lesson from what I'd learned from Mickey Connolly, the featherweight fighter. And he put an end to that. He just bowled me over into a corner and like a barroom fight, and I couldn't get away from him. So we never had a mouthpiece, nothing nice like that. My teeth were rather strong in the corners, so I was bleeding out of the corners of my mouth. And the referee was an employment manager from Glasgow, and he got scared. He knew who I was and how old I was, and he stopped the fight at the end of the second round. So I was kind of sad about that, because it was the only athletic event my father ever saw me in. And he said, don't feel bad, you were just overmatched. But of course I did.
Did you make some money on that?
No, I was the last amateur to fight before the pros. I fought as an amateur. But it was interesting. And
did you get the attention of any of the girls?
Well, no, I don't think so, really, because I was pretty small. 130 pounds and a senior in high school the following year. I was looking up to most of the girls. Once I went to work out here, that was a different thing. The first thing I did was save up money to buy me a brand new car. That took me about a year.
What'd you buy?
I bought a Chevy, and I paid $928 for a brand new Chevy with radio and heater in it, the deluxe job.
You spent that much in 1 year?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
How much were you being paid a week?
Oh, my total salary was about $1,500 for that from January to January that year, but I lived at home, and I also cooked and took care of a grandmother and my father and my little sister, and I'd done all the housework and everything, so my father never charged me anything to live there. Mm-hmm. All the my biggest outlay was 25 cents a day to ride to work at Fort Peck.
On the bus?
Well, no, occasionally. Most of the time we grouped up in cars, and most of the time you could get closer to where your particular group was working. If you found fellow workers, like I worked in the Quarry Stone Rock and Gravel section, and mm-hmm. I'd get with a group that were going right to where they could park near the main office. Saved you a little longer ride in the trucks if you could start from there.
Well, thousands of people here moving to work back and forth. What kind of traffic congestion did that lead to?
The Fort Peck to Glasgow Highway, that stretch of highway, was the highest accident rate of any highway in the United States for a couple of years, and they really had to put the Highway Patrol to work. We didn't have too much enforcement, and at that time, the law was not a speed limit, but that you must be in control of your vehicle. So a lot of guys who had late models like the Ford V8s, 35s, and 6s, who had a hot motor for the size of the car, would see, try to set a record from the gate where you left Fort Peck to where you hit the speed limit in Glasgow. And, you know, it was a dangerous setup. And, of course, in the wintertime, the road was bad anyway. Sometimes it would slate over. But until the Highway Patrol really got tough, and they did put a speed limit on it. At 55, I think. But up till that point, it was very dangerous. And the traffic was pretty heavy. I don't think that they've ever seen anything to compare with it around here since then. And when you went through town, the speed limit was 12 miles an hour. And if they caught you, the federal marshals, who were the police here, would take you to the police station and then just make you sit for an hour or so. If they were going 15, 20 miles an hour, the faster you were going, the longer you had to sit. And then they'd turn you loose and you could go home.
But you lost your shift to work at that rate, probably, if you were
new
on the job.
Which reminds me about there was a little friction sometimes between the Kansas City, Missouri people. Some of them felt that they were a little above the local clodhoppers and farmers. And
what was behind all that?
I really don't know, but they did some of that. I remember in particular a guy by the name of Buck Atwood, who was a foreman down there when the slide slid out and we were rebuilding the trash racks, and there was a local cowboy who wore cowboy boots, but he was a good, hard-working man, by the name of Rex Waggle. And he made a misstep down there. He just had planks to work on, and those trash racks are 4 feet apart. If you fell down in there, you're gone. And he's holding on to an interlacing sheet piling. We're closing that off so we can shut the water away from the tunnels and rebuild the entrance into what they call a trash rack. It was a vertical concrete deal with a V-shaped trash rack of steel on top so as it couldn't happen again. If there was another thing of any kind, nothing, trees, anything will hang up on that brush and it won't go in the tunnel. But at any rate, Buck Atwood was an overbearing, great big man of about 245 pounds and a booming voice. And he called, when Rex Waggle fell and lost the line, the tagline on the steel, he called him a sheep-herding blankety-blank. Well, Rex weighed about 160 pounds, and he come up off the deck and went over there and knocked him flat. And they had him arrested for assault, and he got 30 days in the jail, which was right in behind the drugstore uptown here. And the day Rex got out, they released him. He came around the corner, and here's old Buck Atwood getting his mail. No, Rex flattened him out again, ran and got on the bus, and never came back to the Fort Peck Dam. But we all enjoyed that because Buck Atwood was an overbearing bully.
Mm-hmm.
So even though, but it's just one of those little side things that happened.
When you got your car, did you drive it to work?
No, I never did. My brother drove it out here one night, and a fry cook who was drunk met him head-on and cut the door and the front wheel and all the sides off of it. I didn't even know I had it. I was on the job, and the timekeeper said, "Your brother wrecked your dad's car." And I said, "My dad doesn't have a car." I allowed him to use mine because he was pretty bad off by then from cancer. But I said, "Well, what about the people?" And he said, "Well, the one car, they were all drunk, and nobody got hurt in your dad's car, in my car." So it was fortunate anyway. But at that time, the laws were very lax, and this man that ran into us had a family, and I couldn't guarantee his wages.
Mm-hmm.
But my brother, by physical force, got about $20 out of him, and I had a deductible of $100, so the only thing was I had to switch over then and buy the next car up the line, which was, 19, I guess my first car was a 39, new one, and the next one was a 40, but I just lost the deductible, but it was one of those things, yes, but it was one of those things, again, that was a vicious stretch of highway. It was raining, and the drunk said that he saw three sets of headlights and tried to go in between the middle, and so... But
how'd you feel about losing your brand new car in an accident?
Well, at that age, I bounced back pretty good. I was a little mad at my brother because he wasn't supposed to be driving it. He borrowed it from my dad. But anyway,
What'd you use your car for if you didn't drive it to work?
My father, who was bad off by that time, because he had lost all his businesses in the Depression, he never went through bankruptcy, but there were so many liens against him. Nash Automobile. At that time, if you sold anything, even though the bank had the paper, if you were the agent, you were responsible legally. They changed the law after that. So Nash had probably $150,000 lien against him, and Minneapolis Moline Tractors and Combines had a $200,000 lien against him. Our house was in Mother's name, and this was not a community property state, so that's all we had when it was all over. But he couldn't own anything. mm-hmm. until he paid off all his debts, or else they were outlawed by the time basis, see. So for that reason, I let him have my car. And he had had a tough time, what with mm-hmm. the cancer and everything. But anyway, I did love the people here, and except for the weather being so vicious in the winter, and the fact that there was, that was the main reason I left. But also, if your father hadn't survived the crash and owned a big farm or owned a business where he could put you to work, you were almost certain to be a day laborer in this community. And I figured if I was going to do that and work with my hands, that I'd rather be in a nice climate where I could work year-round. Here you might work 6 months, and then you maybe you won't be too busy in the winter, and you run in debt and have to build out again. So that's the biggest reason I left.
Well, let's talk about the specific jobs that you had when you were here. Your first job was as a table waiter for Addison Miller. What was Addison Miller?
Well, Addison Miller built the spillway and the cutoff walls over there. And they were a combination construction company, Addison Miller, amongst a group of them who went together because they wouldn't be big enough to bid these huge jobs by themselves. So Mason and Waltz, Addison Miller, such teams were actually big construction companies, and as this state would go, but not big enough to handle it by themselves. But I moved from that. When I first came out here, there was a flood at the time, and I came out the 13th of June in 37 as a laborer, and my first job was went out in a rowboat to pull logs and stuff away from the trestle because they were afraid it was going to tear the railroad trestle out that was going across. And that was a little exciting.
So you're pulling all this debris away from the trestles.
Yeah, we managed to keep it from, it piled up pretty deep at times, and we had maybe 20 men in rowboats tying onto this, and in the center you had a slightly wider gap where that you could pull the logs over there and they would go on through and go downstream. Of course, at this time the dam had not been shut off yet. But from that job, then I was put in a rock of gravel gang where we side dumped gravel, and also we built the railroads. You'd put it up about 20 feet at a time up the face side of the dam so they could bring the other railroad trains in to dump gravel and to lay quarry stone. And this railroad was built in section and put on flat cars. You build it up in a yard where they build it in sections, and the rails would be staggered, so one ran about 6 feet by the other, and then you would have it put together all except for the last part of it, and they'd swing it around off a flat car from a steam engine that they had on the front and a railroad train on the back, and he would swing all of those off, and we'd lay them down. As we moved forward, you had a crew waiting there, and they'd have these spud wrench with the tapered end, stick them in on a flange that fits on your rail, stick it in together and drop it down, then you had another crew coming right behind you who were tamping up the rails and putting it together. But we laid rails all the way across the dam in one day with that rig. You had to get
one
back
day.
In one day. You had to get back. Of course, it's all pre-built. But every so often they'd lay a Y down where you could back off and pull that empty car out and switch in a full one and put behind the steam engine again, and your railroad crew was on the end. Most of the railroad engineers were retired people off of the railroads. Well, I remember our Greek section foreman by the name of Panagopoulos had been on the Great Northern for 25 years. He was a very mild man. I was so surprised when I found out he lost his job for hitting the yardmaster on the Great Northern. And I moved up in that particular group pretty good because I was a, well, let's face it, some kids think they're pretty smart. I was about 17 years old, and I was out there on the road, and where he wanted to build a Y. It was up on type in the dock area, in the dike area, and he, although he had been a section foreman, he didn't know how to put that Y together. Well, my dad was a railroad man, and I hung around the railroad tracks, and I had looked at that Y when I was a kid, and I knew how it went. And he's standing there looking at it, like a big dumb kid. I go over to him, and I say, I can build that. He said, you can. And he said, how many men do you need? And I said, about six. And we took the pieces that fit, the heavy-duty pieces that fit. We had to use these rail clamps that you pick it up with, and we packed it all into position. And I built that Y going off out there. And then after that, Panagopoulos thought I was really something. When they'd transfer the rock and gravel guys and the quarry stone over there, sometimes he'd put me in charge of a very large crew, a couple hundred men. And there was a good bit of hard feeling over that with some of the older men, because after all, I was really a kid and I didn't know anything. But I just impressed the section foreman.
Huh.
So it was kind of fun, but from...
Let me switch this over to the other side so we'll get more of the story. Well, how So you became a section foreman?
No, that was just when there weren't any rock in. Sometimes we'd be out of rock. They hauled those in from over towards Harlem area off of Snake Butte, which was, by the way, owned by the Indians, and the Indians made pretty good out of selling that. But when they started laying quarry stone, nobody knew anything about this handling rocks of this size to put on the face, which are to keep the dam from washing away. You had 18 inches of blanket gravel, and then at the very base you had field boulders, and that came up to where they knew there wouldn't be any waves. From where they thought there might be waves big enough to damage the dam as the lake built up, they started laying quarry stone, and they varied in size from, say, 4 feet by 8 feet up to as large as the top of a flat car. When they were that big, we had to drag them off because we couldn't handle them. We'd just pull them off and build around them. But at any rate, when they called for volunteers to be the signal man on this crane, the older men could see that it was going to be dangerous. And he needed about 8 signal men at first, and he's still short 2, and nobody would say anything. So I spoke up and said, I'll try it. So I took this job, and I had these men working with me that might be, the oldest one I had was 60 years old, but I had all people older than myself. So I never told them to do anything. I said, could you do this, or would you do this for me, or would you please do this for me? So I never had any problem with that ending of the thing, and I worked. I broke in quite a few other people who were older than myself. One of them will be in for an interview pretty soon, and then they were made foreman over the top of it because they were older, Montford.
What did it take to do that job? What exactly did you do?
Well, you had to signal the crane, and you were in charge of the crane operator and the oiler and the railroad train, which was your brakeman, conductor, and engineer, and they had usually a bulldozer alongside. When the railroad train would pull out to go after something else, you had a bulldozer to move your cars down one at a time and put them where your crane could make them. And they had at any rate, you worked on a 3-to-1 slope, and you had mats, big plank mats made to level out the drag line, and you had 2 of them. One you'd be on, and then you swung the other around as you moved alongside placing those rocks. They must be placed so there's not a hole any bigger than, say, what you can put a 5-gallon bucket in. Nothing bigger than that, and they frowned on that. We used to try to place them very tight, and if we couldn't find ones that fit, we would take a pointed rock and set it on end in the hole and use another one and drive it in like a pile driver. The men doing that on the cranes got very, very good. I remember a particular crane operator that I had by the name of Bill Mosley, a little guy, handsome little guy with a black mustache, and what a feel he had for it. Nice guy to get along with. They had a contest amongst them one time when there wasn't any rock, and these were shovels, actually, but they had a shovel on this one rig where they were loading and unloading, and they decided to show off, and these guys didn't have any work to do, so you got about 6 crane operators there. First, they were driving in those heavy-duty grade sticks for the surveyor, and then they went to the one that's like a lathe, and they were driving that in with this great big shovel. And my friend Bill Mosley took his good railroad watch and went out there and set it on top of one of those heavy square ones that's about 2 inches across the top. And they would, what they'd done, they would turn their back to it and swing the crane all the way around, or cranes are often converted to drag lines because they were faster. But anyway, this was a shovel. He swung that shovel around and set it right down on the face of that watch. He had the most beautiful control. They were air controlled, hydraulic control. But he was the best that I ever saw.
That is remarkable.
Yes.
You said this was a dangerous job. What was dangerous about
doing
that kind of work?
When we first started these rocks, we were working with cables and chains, and the chains often broke. I had one breaking. It didn't break as such. The drag line operator had it under a huge rock of about 18 ton, maybe, and in order to get it out, he had to pull sideways. He froze at the controls, and when he came around with it, I could hear the pitch of the motor change. But as I turned around, I'm too late to get out of the way because it's snacking like just when you crack a whip is where that chain was going back and forth. And the rocks varied in height of as much as 4 feet. So it hit me and I went over and over backwards, and what saved my bacon, I was wearing an old Frank Buck pith helmet, one of those cork thing. I didn't have any shirt on and it skinned me out just like you sandpapered me. But a broken nose and a few vertebrae in my neck out of place was the worst of it. I was 10 days in the hospital over here at Fort Peck, and that's where I met this Eric Olson that the cat had chewed up so badly, you know, a little caterpillar tractor run up the back of his leg. But I was 10 days in there, and of course I couldn't wait to get out of that and go back to work. But at any rate, there was a good bit of danger connected with the load. They changed to what they call a Lewis pinhole. Some guy invented a deal where you drilled 2 holes about 4 feet apart at about a 30-degree angle, and your chain made a loop. You could pull those 2 things out on this loop and stick the Lewis pinholes around an angle, stick them down in the hole, which was drilled about 8 inches deep, And then as you picked up the rock, you'd get the whole thing. But sometimes there'd be a little excitement because this was granite and it's layered and all you'd get would be the top and then the chains would be snapping all over. You had to run for it quite a bit.
Huh. And, other kinds of accidents that happened during that time?
Oh, yes. There were quite a few. And I wrote a deal for the Fort Peck lady at the Omaha Engineers that I have written down there on Spike Scalicky, a friend of mine who... I can tell it to you, but not word for word of the way I wrote it. But Spike was up on a flat car, and we had a new guy working down with me. Sometimes you'd have as many as three men down on the ground. I signaled the crane and placed the rock, and you had two of the men that took the thing off again and sent it right back up. And you'd done this as fast as you could, and you had a government inspector that checked you out each time. But at any rate, to get back to what could happen, they started down with a rock, and it was... This one was in a chain, and you used to make a sort of a figure eight around them to get a hold of them. Well, it flipped out of it, and it was about, 2 feet thick and maybe 8 feet by 4 feet. And when it fell and hit this blanket gravel, it was just like a big surfboard. And it rode up on this stuff, and this kid trying to get away from it fell down, and that large rock slid up to about his hips, and it was right up on top of him. Spike, who was up on the car, was closer than I was, but he was strong, extremely strong. I saw him deadlift, holding onto a belt against a scale, 1,200 pounds. He jumped on a dead run and ran down there and grabbed a hold of that thing. He's on the downhill side lifting that up, and the guy crawled out from under it, and then he let it back down. And the man was only bruised and skinned up. He wasn't hurt. We're all standing there, and you know how the adrenaline's pumping, and you're all so excited. So Spike went back and tried to lift the rock again. He couldn't touch it. Four of us went there and tried to lift it, and we could not lift that rock. So that shows you what the adrenaline did. But I know he was an exceptionally strong man. And he had come from Chicago, and he was a very quiet type man. He had lost his wife and child in a fire. He was really an electrician, but he didn't want to work at his trade, and he was in that labor gang working for me, an exceptional man. But yes, there were quite a few accidents. When we were shutting off the dam, the water, we were dumping field welders down in there, and one of the men in the rock and gravel crew got hung up in the car, and foreman, or the superintendent of rock and gravel, made a very bad mistake. He sent a man in with a crowbar to lift it up so the rock would come in, and the man fell, and the door closed on him, and then he sent another man with a crowbar. He had his legs in it, and the next time it closed on him, it cut him in two. And there was a great deal of unhappiness about that. That man had us sign a statement that we would never get up in there again like that, and then a week later, he's trying to get some of the men in my crew that I had. We were overworking on that one. There wasn't any quarrystone going to get in there. And so I called him down on it, which didn't sit too popular with the rest of the people. I told him, what the hell's going on? You told us that you made us all sign this written statement that we wouldn't get up inside that car, and now you're asking us to do it. Well, this is different, he said. And I said, no, it's not. My men are not going in there. But at any rate, this is the safety factor. The Army engineers themselves tried to run a safe job, but you had a lot of people underneath them who were pushing to make a name for themselves, and oftentimes they'd done things that weren't too smart.
What did the workers do when there were unsafe conditions? You say, was there a lot of turmoil about that?
It was very difficult to do anything because oftentimes you couldn't get any action, and if you went over the head, you might be fired. I'll give you a little example of what you could get into here. When I first started signaling and placing this rock on the dam, I was getting 60 cents an hour. And there were about 30 of us, and that's all we'd done was signal this rock. And they kept us around because we already knew the job. And by this time, I've matted about 2 years, and I decided that since the riggers who were doing the same job were getting $1.20, we were entitled to more. So I talked it up amongst the men, and we had a man by the name of Fred Peterson, who was a pretty good talker, and he was spokesman. But he asked me to go in with him. So we go into this man who was in charge of the rock and gravel section was Pete Snell. So we go into his office, and Fred Peterson froze up and couldn't say a word. So me, I'm 18 years old, I give the spiel about what we had to have or we're going to walk off the job. And they pretty much put a mark on me for that. We got our money, and we went on to work. But the first time there was a slack period, I remember I worked at the inlet portals when they were redoing the trash racks after the slide. And when my vacation time came up, one of the people who were around me when I gave this little spiel tried to get me to sign that I would go on my vacation. He tried to get me to cut my pay to 60 cents an hour before I went on vacation. I was drawing 75. And I said, oh, no, I'm not about to. And he laid me off. He says, I guess you're laying for asking for a layoff slip. This was Al Davis that did that, a lieutenant. He was by then in charge, top man. And he let me go. But by the time spring rolled around, my vacation was a month long. By the time they were ready to go work in the Quarry Stone again, by then people in the Quarry Stone section spoke up for me, and I never missed any time. They pulled me right back out to work. But I didn't take that cut and pay for my vacation either. I'd have rather took a kick in the teeth.
Is that a very common thing?
Oh, yes, they've done that to a lot of people. And it was just swinging his weight around. He was a bad man for that. And lots of those Army officers were inclined to lean on you.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, like you ask about, feeling between the people. Major Larkin and Major Kittrell both lived in town, and I went to school. Catherine Kittrell was a sweetheart of a lady. She was in my mechanical drawing class and went into engineering. But the other family were, well, snobs is the only word for it. They were not popular in town, and they looked down their nose at everyone. So you had a little bit of it, pardon me, but only at that level. I never ran into it anywhere else.
What was the, if there was such feeling at times about working conditions, was there ever any kind of talk about a union?
Well, outside of myself, no. And the reason for that, although the Wheeler and Roosevelt, when this thing came in, the ruling was that if you were a skilled laborer, that you must be paid the skilled labor wage. And the minimum wage was 50 cents an hour, which was a godsend to the people here because, let's face it, the wages at that time for a good man in town were a dollar a day. If you were a head clerk in a grocery store or whatever, that type of thing, and had a steady job, a dollar a day was very good. And you're not talking about 8 hours, you're talking about 12. You came out here and you got 50 cents an hour for an 8 hour day. Boy, by the time I worked up to 75 cents an hour, hell, the vice president of the bank in town at Lewis and Wiedem's, I knew him. He was making about the same as me, and here I am out here just working. So you can see what a boost it was. Dragline operators and some of the other people in real heavy equipment, like the big Letourneau carryalls that they pull the dirt for the core where they fill the crew, they were $1.20 an hour. And, of course, that base pay, minimum wage law of 50 cents, was such a great help to everybody because otherwise, you know, you're looking at $1 a day.
Mm-hmm.
So it really pulled the people up out of a hole, and probably through the Depression time, through Senator Wheeler's effort of bringing that dam in here, I think that was the biggest boost that this part of the country ever had. And, of course, you got a little bit of a break. If you were on what they call a big dry, where your farms were covered up by the lake, and those people got a bad deal because they really didn't get what their places were worth, it was a choice land of this part of the country along the Missouri River. But every man who had one of those farms, if he wanted the job, was allowed a foreman job at Fort Pitt Dam. And a great many of them took these jobs. I can remember one old Broken Nose cowboy by the name of Kirk Breckenridge. But a great many of those people did take a foreman job and work from as early as the middle 30s until the project was winding down to where they started to lay them off. But so they did get some of it back. That gave them a chance to earn a couple dollars a day more than the rest of them. And that was a nice thing they did do. The Corps of Engineers did do that. But buying the farms for them was kind of sad. Ira Turtelot worked here as a government marshal, and he was a rancher from south of Glasgow, but he worked as, you know.
Doing fine. I don't know what's going on with this machine that's going, clicking off occasionally. Shouldn't be doing that. Go right ahead.
Well, anyway, Ira Turtelot represented the government, and you had a referee who was the government man who had a price that he could pay. And Ira used to come by my dad's house and get him to represent the farmers, and they would go out together, and when these places are going to be covered by the water, and of course the farmer would be there, and they would go over the property and what was going on, and they would set a price. Of course, this was condemned property, so the poor farmer had no say. And my dad would come home, and so would Turtelot, who was the opposite side of the fence, feeling so bad because it was never quite what it should have been. It was something, and of course in the Depression it helped them. But I can remember another thing. I saw such a beautiful home when I went down there to work in the woods, clearing trees where the lake would be. They would buy these homes up, and then no one could touch those homes. This is a rather strange rule to me. I remember one with hardwood floors and beautiful, up on a big knoll, one of the most beautiful homes in town. It would have been as nice as anything in Glasgow. They locked that all up, and then they set fire to those places. They burned them to the ground. You couldn't take a window. You couldn't take anything. They bought that house, and that was theirs, and they burned it. And that was something that I thought was, well, I thought it was a little dumb.
How'd people feel about that?
Very bad.
What'd they do about it?
Not a damn thing. They had sold their house, and that belonged to the government. The government felt there was too much pilfering, and if they got down in there, there would be, somebody might get hurt or whatever. Anyway, I can't exactly imagine all the excuses the government used, but that is what they did. You couldn't go back. You couldn't haul, you couldn't tear down and haul the lumber away. You couldn't do nothing with it, even if it was been your home. You could take your furniture out and goodbye.
Did people try to get around that somehow?
No.
No.
No. No. You. It was very tough to get in and out of there.
Was there hard feeling between some of the ranchers?
Oh, the ranchers who owned that property, they were the ones who were against the dam, and of course the Republican community in Glasgow at that time who were doing business with them also backed them and were against the dam and were never for it, although they now take all the bows. But Senator Wheeler was the main man, and of course some of the Montana governors who were along at that time, Cooney and Ayers, but Wheeler was the main man who was able to promote the money in the Senate and Congress to bring it into the state. Inasmuch as every state was in a depression and was trying to furnish money for their own. So that was, I wish that Senator Wheeler was being given the credit now that he should. Instead, when I went to a speech here a few years back, many of the local dignitaries were people who had opposed this thing. And I felt a little badly to think that history would slough by them so fast and not say what had happened.
Why did the Republicans oppose the dam?
Well, I don't know. Mostly at that time, they were pretty much, you might say, the Gannett Party. When we went to build the airport up on top of the hill, they fought that too. I really don't know. Anything that wiped out any of the local community, which was the farms on the North Bench at that time, they were already here and in business, and these people were their friends, so they bunked it for that reason. They didn't have the foresight to see what this dam would mean to the community like it does now, where you have power, recreation, boating, fishing, and so many things that it's done for this community. Well, it changed the whole environment. And they couldn't see that far ahead, apparently.
Did it become a partisan issue in the community?
At that time, for about 3 years, it was. Yes, in the papers, if I could dig up any of the old Glasgow couriers, I could certainly show you some of the stuff that they were printing at that time. At that time, you had a paper called the Glasgow Times, and their editor was a man by the name of Gordon Blandingham, who, by the way, in this year of 87, he retired at the year. He was 92 years old. He went to work for the Mercury News in San Jose, and he continued to work over there after he froze out of business here. The Republican papers didn't like any opposition, and they brought in two other papers, and they set up a daily, and they set up a weekly, plus the Glasgow Courier, to run the other papers out of business here, and they were successful. They had the money, the Democrats didn't. There wasn't enough subscriptions to float even enough money amongst the smaller group of Democrats, and they ran the paper out. However, now the Glasgow Courier, in my opinion, is representative of the community as a whole and does an excellent job. But at that time, it was a Republican paper, and it was honest, but it was not, you didn't see both sides of things because they ran the other paper off.
Was there an organized effort in the community to support getting the money for the dam?
Well, I don't think that a great deal of people understood what it was all about way back at the outset when Wheeler was promoting it. They knew that there was a talk of shutting the river up here and making a dam, but I don't think they had any notion of how big this whole thing was going to be. And I don't believe there really was, outside of a few prominent Democrats in the community, I don't believe there was much of an effort. John David was a big Democrat out by Vandalia at that time. He was one of them.
Your father was also very active in the Democratic
Party. Yeah, he was.
Did you understand what this
dam was? Oh, yes, Dad knew. Wheeler laid it all out for Dad. He talked with him as much as 3 hours at a time in our home. And he laid it all out for him, what would happen, what we could expect in the way of benefits to the community. And that was very important. I wasn't old enough to appreciate the fact that when people like Wheeler and the Governor Ayers and Cooney and at one time Senator Walsh came by my house, I was introduced to them, but it really didn't register very well because, you know, at that time, like, the oldest I was, the last time I saw Wheeler, I was about 14 years old, and although I realized by then that he was a very important man, I really didn't know that he was the head of the Senate and so on.
But you were a bit older then when...
Then I went to work at 16. By then, I realized
right. Better.
But I have... I have a letter in particular that I think about where Warren Joe Chouinard, was what he was known as, was crippled clearing brush out here in the early going, maybe 34, somewhere there, 32. And at that time, we didn't have a very good protection system for anybody who was injured. The federal government didn't. And my father went to Senator Wheeler and asked him if he would introduce the bill and try to get some money for him. And he put a bill on the floor of the Senate, but that was very difficult in Depression time to have a thing, a minor thing for one man and get him any help. He was in a wheelchair the rest of his life, and as far as I know, he never received any help for that injury. Mm-hmm. That was that.
There were other cases. You showed me a letter from Governor Ayers related to another situation where people weren't compensated.
Yes, well, that was a wages deal where the weather was very bad. We were clearing timber out in the big dry area, Haxby, down in that direction, and it took us, well, better part, 16 hours out of the day to get over there and get back, and we'd ride in these trucks with about 20 men to a truck to get there from the fill office down at the bottom of the face side of the dam where the fill office was. And we would start from there in these trucks, and they had a canvas drop down on the back of them was all they had to keep you warm. The rest was what you wore in body heat in the back. We'd ride those things out there, and sometimes we're looking at as many as 40 miles. When the spring thaw started, by 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning, it was starting to get slippery. Sometimes it would only work as little as 2 hours. And coming back, there were times when we had ropes, big ropes about as big around as your arm, that came off of the dredges, and they'd be, 80 feet long, and you might have 20 trucks in a row, and when you come to a hill, they could no longer make up the hill with chains. Everybody get out, and you hook that thing on the front. And there are some photos around, but I don't have one. We would pull those trucks up until all that group of trucks was up on top, and we'd all load into our trucks again and go until we couldn't make it again, and then we would pull the trucks on up. But at any rate, we spent about 3 weeks in very bad weather, where oftentimes we were 16 hours going and coming to make that job from the fill office. When I told my dad about it, he felt that we, according to the labor agreement, we were supposed to be compensated when it went beyond a reasonable time to get to work and back. So Senator Wheeler did introduce a bill again on that and on the floor, but he was unsuccessful in getting any money. We never got anything. But it was such difficult times, and times are so bad. Any kind of extra compensation was very difficult to get out. They naturally thought we were lucky to have a job where we could make a living, and we did too. Mm-hmm. But
you did raise the point that though there was some disgruntledness over the way workers were treated occasionally, but there wasn't a lot of talk about union except you. What did you think about having a union?
Well, of course, I really didn't try to organize a union as such where you had pay dues, but I did organize a set-up strike amongst the signals men or the rock spotters. We were sub-foremen in the quarrystone section, and inasmuch as we were the key man in the crew, if all of us left, it would have taken them probably several months to break in a crew to be as good as we were, because we'd already been at it a couple of years. So when I went to talk to them, I did threaten a walkout, but as far as trying to have a union paying dues, I never did. There were some union men on the job, but they were out of Glasgow unions like the Carpenters or the Brotherhood of Local Votive Railmen, who were bringing in the quarry stone and all of the things that they brought in to build the dam. They were all Brotherhood of Locomotive Railmen, but their union was already organized and they were already members. I don't know of any union that was ever organized successfully here on the dam itself.
Did you talk to your men about the possibility of the strike, and what was their discussion like?
Oh, they were all for it. The crew itself was not involved in this. This is strictly the rock spotters. The crew still, the best they could get up to is if they're a especially good man, you could get them a rating of 60 cents, a dime above the 50 cents. Most of the crew were 50 cents an hour. But the rock spotters all felt that because of the danger involved at that particular job, you had your face within, sometimes you were touching the rock even, you had your face right up next to it, and if anything went wrong, why, you were the one that was going to get it.
Mm-hmm.
And some of that rock tonnage was so immense. That one that I got that was as big as a flat car, it was only about 30 inches thick, but it was curved a little bit like a boat. And that thing took up from one end to the other, and we pulled it into where it was just ahead of the drag line, so he could put a full drag on it on an angle. And he lowered the boom all he could, because if he had his boom up, it'd pull him over frontwards. And then he pulled that rock off, and it just cleared the tracks enough so we could leave it lay, and we strictly built rocks around it. There was no use trying to move it. And they said that they figured that one weighed, I'm not certain, but it seemed that they said it was around 30 ton. But it wasn't thick. It was so immense, though, that you couldn't handle it.
Mm-hmm.
There were others probably that weighed as much that were shaped different.
Would you all have gone through with the strike?
Oh, sure. We were ready to leave. It was spring, and we could have got a job someplace else by that time. Maybe not in that same gang, but we could have got back out to work.
Were there other threatened strikes?
I didn't know of any. I'm sure that there was unhappiness. I was pouring concrete down in a hole one time. I was supposed to be the signalman on the crane, but when I got over there, somebody was already doing it, and the superintendent sent me down the hole on a post vibrator. I got down there with a Butte Miner, and the pour was about 24 feet by 64 feet, and it's a continuous pour. And your steel around the edge was the only steel that was around the main body of that concrete. And they threw a mat in there every once in a while, but there was nothing for you to stand on. You had to walk constantly to keep from sinking. This Butte Miner I was with was an old big man, probably 225 pounds, I'm about 130. He lost his boots in there, and he said, "Ray, I'm single. I don't have to do this." And he climbed over on the structural steel on the wall and disappeared. That's the last I ever saw him. And that man left me down there on that thing the rest of the ship by myself. And it was a post vibrator is like it sounds. It's shaped like a big post with a double handle on the top. I'm dragging that thing up out of there and then scrambling to try to keep from sinking the rest of the ship. And I got cement in my eyes, and we're pouring with heaters down there because it's like 40 below outside.
Let's go right ahead.
Well, anytime you feel like I've talked long enough.
No, it's just all right. Opposite.
Anyway, we were pouring with these huge heaters, and they kept the temperature at about 60 degrees in there, and I got some of that cement in my eyes wrestling that post-vibrator by myself, so I drug it over the edge and stuck it into the steel and climbed up and washed my eyes out many times because I knew another man that had set up on his eyes, and he had to have his eyes scraped for about a week to get that concrete off. So at any rate, when I came up out of that shift that day, I was dying because I was so tired. And I got in my truck at the foot of the hill, and we rode up by the shafts. We were near the shafts where we were working, up over the top. Well, it was the entrance to the tunnels, up over the top and down to the fill office. And by the time I got over there, all of my clothes were frozen stiff from perspiration, and it was just like a tin woodman, you know. And I was riding with a man who was not adverse to having a nip with him. And I got in the car, and I was a teetotaler. I said, "I don't drink herb, but if you got anything in there..." And so I took a big, long slug out of his bottle, and I never even got a cold out of the deal, but boy, it felt good to have some warmth run through my body.
Well, I bet it did. Let's go to another tape and start another one.